Hi, it's Patrick Cox here. And when I say Hawaii, what do you think? I'll give you a few seconds during this announcement.
The World in Words is made possible in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, exploring the human endeavor.
Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.
Okay, Hawaii thoughts. Let's get tropical paradise out of the way. What else? I think volcanic. I love volcanic landscapes. I think Barack Obama. Also, the Hawaiian language, which may be making a comeback after teetering on the verge of extinction. Other languages too, Japanese, Chinese, reflections, I suppose, of migration patterns there, and a reflection of the fact that Hawaii is the only state never to have had a white majority. Here's something that doesn't come to mind. Siberia. Now, as unlikely as it seems, there is a connection, something that harks back to the days before Hawaii was a state, when it was an American territory. And this episode from history has been retrieved thanks to researchers working out of the University of Hawaii who've put a rare album of immigrant photos and other information. They put it online. So here goes with a story that says plenty about American attitudes to race. And also, in a small way, it says something about how sometimes you just can't bridge the language gap. Here's Alina Simone.
4 years ago, I went on a Hawaiian vacation. No, I didn't go snorkeling. I spent nearly all my time in the bowels of a university archive, browsing 100-year-old newspapers. The truth is, I can only stand so much sand and sea. And when I happened to type two words into Google, Russians and Hawaii, I stumbled across a startling historical footnote. At the turn of the last century, the Hawaiian Board of Immigration imported more than 1,500 Russians, mostly from Siberia, to work the island's sugar plantations in a last-ditch effort to make Hawaii more white.
They had brought in Asian labor at first, Chinese and Japanese laborers.
This is Patricia Polanski, Russian bibliographer at University of Hawaii's Hamilton Library. Asian labor was the backbone of the early sugar industry, but it was a brutal way to make a living. In 1909, several thousand Japanese laborers went on strike, demanding better pay and working conditions, which worried plantation owners.
So they decided they wanted to try what we call haole labor or white labor.
A report issued by the Commissioner of Labor on Hawaii described local planters as, quote, willing without reserve to employ all the Caucasian workers the government can bring to the islands at a wage one-third larger than what was paid Asian laborers.
And when the plantation owners were looking around for white groups, there happened to be in Honolulu a man named Perl Strauss, who was a Russian kind of entrepreneur.
Kind of is kind of the key here. Perl Strauss drew up a recruitment brochure for the Russians, and according to Amir Hizimudinov, historian at Far Eastern Federal University in Khabarovsk, once Perl Strauss and his crew reached Russia,
they always make huge, huge propaganda. You need to come, we're doing for you big possibilities to work, good weather.
There were all kinds of things in there. They would be given a little house, how many hours they had to work, what their wages would be.
Right. The brochure also suggested the Russians would be given their own land.
But that actually didn't turn out to be true, of course. They were coming just to work on the plantations. So that was part of what caused a lot of the trouble after the Russians got here.
After getting a taste of plantation life, the Russians went on strike. To better understand their rebellion, I drove out to Hawaii Plantation Village in Waipahu, an outdoor museum of plantation life. Even though it's only a few miles from the beach, Waipahu is nothing like the Azure Coast. And when I touched an actual sugarcane plant, it felt more like a weapon than food. The Siberians probably imagined they were traveling to an island paradise. Instead, they ended up in quarantine after measles broke out on their steamer. Their encampment on a Honolulu wharf became a tourist draw, while the newspapers made a circus out of the immigration snafu. According to Amir Hizimudinov, a large part of this was due to communication failure.
Language, it was really huge problem, very huge problem for Russians in Hawaii. They don't have interpreters.
There were so few Russian speakers in Hawaii, they recruited a local actress to help negotiate disputes, like one that broke out when the Russians tried bathing in the nude on a public beach. And there wasn't much cultural interpretation. Everything in Hawaii was totally alien to the Russians, from the local cuisine to the tropical weather. And there was no community hub, no church, no expat ambassadors to help explain
what they must be doing, what their obligations, what they may for children, for education. I think it's the biggest mistake from authorities in Hawaii. They didn't describe.
The Russians fled Hawaii in droves, many headed for California or New York. A few returned to Russia. But the story has another twist. Several years after the Russians first arrived in Hawaii, the Russian Revolution took place. That was 1917. And the new government headed by Vladimir Lenin wanted the Russians in Hawaii to come back home.
So Moscow sent a man here whose name was Trautsholt. And his job, he had money. He was to pay their passage back to Russia. And he was to fill out their passport applications and everything. And that's what this album is that we have. We have the passport application album.
What Patricia Polanski is talking about here is a kind of scrapbook that Trautsholt compiled, filled with portraits and biographical sketches of the Russians who remained. It's an extraordinary document, probably the only place you'll find photos of Russian men with handlebar mustaches, wearing Hawaiian work clothes. Few people took Trautsholt up on his offer of free passage to war-torn communist Russia, but some who did never forgot Hawaii. Fast forward several decades to the collapse of the Soviet Union and...
One day I had a phone call from Catholic Charities and they said, oh, there's a Russian woman here. I met her and she was carrying an urn with her that had her mother's ashes in it. And it happened to be that her mother was born here in Hawaii. She was a child of one of these people that came here to work on the plantations. But her family had decided to repatriate to Soviet Union.
When her mother was on her deathbed, she told her daughter, I want to be buried in Hawaii. With the Iron Curtain firmly in place, that didn't seem likely. So she waited.
And the minute the Soviet Union collapsed, she put herself on an airplane and showed up in Hawaii with her mother's ashes.
Not all their encounters with descendants have been this dramatic, of course. But once Patricia and Amir put the Russian passport album online, they began to connect even more families with the long-lost Russians of Hawaii.
We have been contacted by, I'd say, maybe 30 people that are descendants of people listed in the album.
It's funny to think what Hawaii might look like had the Russian immigration scheme succeeded. Would the islands be dotted with borscht stands today? Would balalaika jam bands be performing at the annual Island Arts Festival? These are questions you can spend an entire tropical vacation contemplating. But given this is a place where you can find sushi made from spam, I doubt there's any influence Hawaii can't absorb. For the world, this is Alina Simone.
This, if you haven't recognized it, is Russia's national anthem. This ukulele rendition is by Bruce Spiegelmeier. Who knows? He may have some Russian or some Hawaiian blood in him. Or both. Now, it may or may not have escaped your attention that a French judge this week said no to a particular baby name. Baby names. We love baby name stories. This judge told the baby's parents that they could not call their child by the name that they chose. Here on the pod, there is only one person I can talk to about this. Cartoon queen, Carol Hills. Carol.
Patrick.
Would you ever consider calling a child Nutella?
No. It's something I would consider spreading on a piece of bread, but not naming my child, no.
Would you defend the right of a parent to call their child Nutella in France?
Yes, I am big on this. I don't think a government should be telling you what you can name your kid. Even though I think it's a stupid name, I would defend the right for somebody to name their kid that, yes.
One of the things I really love about when these things come up, and there's been actually a couple of them, I'll mention the other one in a bit, but is the reaction of the authorities. In this case, it was a judge in France. And the judge said that calling the baby girl Nutella would make her the target of derision. which made me laugh. As somebody whose last name is Cox, I was the target of derision for many, many years by young boys especially.
And you've grown up into a healthy individual.
I'm fine. I think baby Nutella, who now is being forcibly renamed Ella, because the parents didn't show up to the court hearing. I think baby Nutella would have been fine.
Yeah, but I mean, they can privately still call her Nutella.
That'll be her nickname, no doubt, yeah. The other case was from Denmark. And now Denmark is very much one of those Scando countries that is very nanny state-ish about names, probably less so than the Icelanders, who are sort of like ground zero for naming.
Yeah, but the Scandos, they're also groovy.
They're groovy, but the Norwegians, the Swedes, the Icelanders, and as I now understand it, the Danes as well, they don't let you get away with certain names. There was a guy who is fully grown. He's an adult, and his name is Benjamin Preisler Herbst. Okay, totally normal Danish name. He wants to change his name to superhero Benjamin Preisler Herbst. And again, I think that the best moment in this is the reaction of the authorities in turning him down. This is what they said. The word superhero is a term for a fictional slash non-existent figure who performs heroic acts. We don't believe that superhero lives up to the criteria for being approved as a boy's name.
Wow.
Really? Come on.
Wow. That's just amazing to me. I mean, I am wondering whether he would sign checks, or if he still signed checks, like superhero. Would that be his name?
Oh, yeah, but that would be the great thing, wouldn't it?
It's just so amazing to me that a government will spend time on these things like this.
Can you remember that Singaporean criminal called Batman Bin Superman? S-U-P-A-R-M-A-N. I don't know what happened there with the unconventional spelling.
Well, isn't Kate Winslet, her husband's name is Rock and Roll. He renamed himself like Ned Rock and Roll.
Well, you know, that's what the Brits and the Americans, they let us make fools of ourselves.
Yeah.
What are you going to change your name to?
I don't know. I'm trying to think. I don't have a good name on me right now.
You know, I call you Cartoon Queen. Why don't you just change your name to Cartoon Queen? Cartoon Queen Hills.
Yes.
That would look good on a checkbook.
And what would you have changed your last name to growing up?
Boy, I don't know. I got called Egg when I was a child.
Oh, dear.
Maybe I could just call myself Egg. E-G-G. It's not going to upset anyone.
My nickname was Klingon when I was younger.
You don't want to call yourself that, Carol. So your recommendation for Nutella's parents might be to what? Move to America?
Move to America or just privately call her Nutella. I'd say defy the authorities.
Carol Hills, regular on the pod, though not regular enough. Regular on the big show too. But the best place to find her is on Twitter. Her handle is Global Cartoons. Okay, that's it for this pod. We have a bunch of pictures from the Russian passport application album. That's at PRI.org/language. You can also get there via the World in Words page on Facebook. I am on Twitter. My handle is Patry Cox, PatriCox. And if you're looking around for another podcast to listen to, go to soundworks.org. See you next time.
The World in Words is made possible in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, Exploring the Human Endeavor. The World in Words is also supported in part by PRI's New Voices Fund, bringing new perspectives and personalities to public media. Donors to the fund include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation.
Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.